This is the State of Things broadcasting from the Museum of Natural Sciences in downtown Raleigh. I'm Frank Stachow. Bugs, those creepy critters you try to keep out of your home, annoying pests that ruin your garden, pesky mosquitoes that wreck your picnic. But scientists joining me today say these six-footed friends are not all bad. In fact, they can teach us a lot about the world around us. And the Museum of Natural Sciences is celebrating arthropods this Saturday with Bug Fest, featuring more than 100 exhibits, crafts, games, activities, and, of course, bugs. Dan Dabrowski is chief veterinarian here at the museum, and he studies a bug that we're all sure to love, the hissing cockroach. Dan, we don't applaud for you. We actually hiss.
Thank you very much.
It's good to have you here. Julie Urban has been on the program before. She is an assistant director of genomics and microlab here at the Nature Research Center. She recently peeled a mite from my face and is now back for more. Hi, Julie. Good
Hi.
To have you here.
Great to see you.
And Matt Bertone is an entomologist with the North Carolina State University Plant Disease and Insect Clinic. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Dan, let's talk about these hissing cockroaches. What are you doing with them?
Yeah, so we've got a project, actually an experiment that we're going to be running during our Bug Fest event. So visitors can come and experience this and see us collect data. We're going to be anesthetizing Madagascar hissing roaches.
So you put them to sleep.
Yeah, yeah. So this is sort of the basics of veterinary science. You know, we know how to get your dog. If you have a procedure, you bring your dog to the veterinarian. You do something. You need him to sleep, to be still, sort of not to feel what you're doing. And we want to do this with Madagascar hissing roaches.
And you're using a technique. I mean, part of it is to figure out what the safest way to anesthetize animals is.
Yeah, exactly. On the surface, some of this seems sometimes a little silly. It's always fun. But actually, it's very important. You know, we need to know and understand sort of these basic techniques, just like we do with people and dogs and cats. We need to understand with our invertebrates how we can get them to sleep, to be still, to work with them in a safe way that then we can recover, not just for your pets. You may have pet invertebrates or in this case, pet insects, but also for wildlife and agricultural species. And, you know, if you've got something that you're working on that's rare in the wild or an endangered species and you've got to do a procedure or if you've got to look closely at them, you know, you need to be able to do that safely, and we're hoping to establish sort of the basics of vet medicine in this case with a roach to help push that envelope with insects.
So you're pioneering the technique with this animal. Is there anything in particular you'd like to find out once you've got it kind of woozy?
Yeah, yeah. So we're going to try to get them to sleep. We're going to monitor their sort of level of anesthesia or planes of anesthesia. That's what we call it, sort of their depth of sleeping. Mm-hmm. And as they get into an appropriate level of sleep, we'll monitor the movement. We'll see if they can go sort of from their feet, from their back to their feet and back and forth. And then we'll remove the anesthetic agent. We'll take them off the gas. We'll open them up to room air, and we'll work that process in reverse to make sure that we get a full recovery. And all this will help us establish if this is a safe way to anesthetize, in this case, the hissing roach, but really be able to apply this to right. other invertebrates and other insects in particular.
See, what I think is great about this is you put a bunch of cockroaches to sleep, and then I could run around their house while they're sleeping. Isn't
yeah.
that cool?
Yeah,
I love
good.
That.
That's good.
You
got to
do that.
A question earlier was, what does an anesthetizer or sleeping cockroach look like? And it looks just like you'd think. They're kind of on their backs with their
yeah.
feet up in the air.
That's
so.
The best way. But, although these animals, I have to say, I find them that's a beautiful animal in a way. They're sleek. They're kind of attractive. They're symmetric. I think they're kind of beautiful.
They really are. They're really the particular species we're working with. You know, they're great animals. They're long-lived. We talked about that. This is actually a roach that can live 3 years, 4 years. So they're long-lived. This particular species, as an adult, does not fly. It's a species that lives on the ground. Most roaches, there are thousands of species of cockroaches. Most of them are very beneficial. They eat debris and detritus. There are only a few pest species, really, that sort of give them a bad name.
In fact, this one would be very unhappy under my sink.
Very unhappy, yes.
That's the deal. Well, thanks, Dan. So I want to talk some more about this. Julie, you're working on a different creature. Tell us what you're working on.
Yes, I study plant hoppers. And so this is a group of sap-feeding insects, and their closest relatives we're most familiar with are cicadas. And so plant hoppers, like cicadas, they have their mouth parts fused into a straw-like beak that they use to feed on plant sap. And so I travel around the world and collect these insects and amplify their DNA to see how they're related to each other. But I also study the very special bacteria that they have in their abdomens that are a little bit more special than bacteria we all have in our abdomens. They actually feed the insects from the inside out.
Wait a minute. And they have lots of different kinds of bacteria, right?
Yes. So in their guts, just like us, they would have many different species.
Right.
But they actually – plant hoppers will – there's several species of these – we call them endosymbiotic bacteria because they're symbiotic. They're beneficial. They live internally. And there's between 5 and 7 different species of these bacteria that are enclosed in cellular envelopes that the plant hopper actually – creates and then aggregates all of the bacteria in the same species into a special organ. And so for us, our organs are made out of our cells, our liver is meat, but these guys actually have multiple organs that are comprised of bacteria.
Wow. And so, but do they have the same function? They help the animal, they help the plant hopper digest?
They actually make food for the plant hoppers.
Wow.
So because the plant hoppers feed on plant phloem, which is just really sugar water, that doesn't have the amino acids that the plant hoppers need for proteins. And so we believe based on genome sequencing of other critters that these bacteria are making amino acids, but nobody's really studied. So one of the things I'm doing is sequencing these endosymbiont genomes to see what genes are there, because that can tell us what they're actually doing for the animals, because they might be doing other things too.
And what's cool about this is now that we have the technology to do this genomic kinds of studies, this takes us really to the next level. It was cool to find out that they had all this stuff, so we could figure out what it had, how it worked to some extent, or why it worked. But now you can get down to the DNA level and see precisely what's going on.
Right. And we might be able to use this. I mean, if they're detoxifying plant compounds, potentially that could have pharmaceutical applications. You know, we don't know, because these bacteria cannot be grown. They've co-evolved with the plant hoppers for so long. They can't be grown on their own. They can't live outside of the plant hopper.
Wow, they've become that attached. In other words, they've evolved.
Hundreds of millions of years.
Wow.
With these guys.
And here's the other. So do we know if this is their waste, if this is the bacteria waste that is the protein, or are they generating this as some kind of altruistic, I got to make you happy because I don't live if you don't live?
I think it seems to be beneficial at this point,
right?
Because those bacteria can't live anywhere else. But what's interesting is that it's thought that these infections incurred by it started as a pathogenic problem. So the whole idea that, why would a plant hopper or another insect wrap a cellular wall around this thing other than to rope it off and keep it from monkeying with its DNA? And so it's thought that these relationships originally evolved as a pathogenic situation. And so this is why plant hoppers are so unique among all the critters out here who have endosymbionts, because, they get an infection. Their main infection was inherited by a common ancestor 270 million years ago. You get a second one 140 million years later. You get a third one. And then some plant hoppers have actually even replaced one of these bacteria with a fungal symbiont. So there's some really interesting dynamic things going on with the plant hoppers that aren't going on in anyone else.
That is so cool, because here's the bacteria says, oh, hey, we can infect this guy. Let's just eat him. And then the response is kind of an arms race. And so the plant hopper says, we'll do that. We'll circle you up and you can't do that anymore. And then the bacteria says, look, why don't we make peace with these guys? How about if we just help them live and we'll live here? They built us a wall, for goodness sake. Why don't we just stay here and live? Wow.
It's crazy.
This is crazy stuff. And they make sounds. You talked about them being related to the cicada. They do make kind of mating sounds, but in a very different way, right?
Yes. They have the same – they have a timble, which is the ear. So it's the same structure that cicadas have that they all use to hear. But in the timble in a cicada, there's air sacs. And so the cicada will vibrate those air sacs, and that vibration is airborne. So that's how they hear it. They hear it through their timble, but we can hear it because it's airborne. Plant hoppers will actually shake their substrate. They don't have those air sacs. So they vibrate their plant and they hear it with their timble, just like any other insect hears with their timble. And we can't hear it because it's not airborne, but if we stick a microphone in a plant, we can hear the plant vibration and then we can hear what they're hearing.
And it turns out you did just that. Let's listen. So So he's in there shaking the plant, essentially vibrating the plant, and it's acting like a kind of a big speaker, right?
Yep.
It's like the hollow guitar, right? It's amplifying the sound.
Yes.
It's getting out to the ear. Is that so? You can't necessarily hear it with a naked ear, but you didn't process that at all. You had a microphone just stuck inside
the plant. Yes, and actually, this recording, it's from a book, Insect Sounds and Communication, that was published by CRC Press. So this is another other scientist who did these recordings. But yes, if you just stick the microphone in the plant, you can detect this call. And there's actually a female elsewhere on the plant, and she can call back. And so they call back and forth to each other until they find each other and mate.
Do they kind of have to be on the same plant to find each other?
Yes, it
wow.
seems so.
Because that guy, he's not, because you could tell he was getting kind of excited.
Yes.
I mean, it just felt that way to me. I don't know.
Indeed. Yep.
Well, that's the kind of deal. This is very cool stuff. Well, we're going to keep talking about this. But, Matt, I want to talk with you, the star of the, I think perhaps, if not the hissing cockroach, the star of the show would be the stink bug.
This year's theme for Bugfest is the stink bug. I'm not sure how many actual true bugs we've had as themes for Bugfest. We may have had the cicada. I'm not sure, but this may be the first one, true bug. And now, true bugs are Julie's group, the plant hoppers and aphids and things like that are in one group. And the stink bugs are in a different group. These are the heteroptera is what we call them. Now, stink bugs and leaf-footed bugs are very famous for their really nasty scents. But most bugs, especially in the juveniles, have these scent glands that produce an array of chemicals. Mm. And they're mostly used for defense, but they can be used for all different other things. And they're little chemical factories, really. And even some predators will actually use those chemicals to home in on those bugs.
Oh, so they figured this. So they get the trick, and they say, that's helped me locate you.
Exactly.
That would be a bad defense.
Yeah.
And so how have this has evolved? Obviously, you said other insects have this, but these guys have taken it to a high art.
Yeah, as far as, other insects have pheromones, sex pheromones, and different chemicals they produce, but heteropterans, these true bugs, things like I said, stink bugs, but also bed bugs, assassin bugs, even aquatic bugs like water striders and such, they have these specialized glands that produce these chemicals, and basically they kind of experiment around, produce dozens of types of chemicals, and some are used to attract mates, and others are just used to warn that they're distasteful, or they can actually sometimes be toxic to other predators and things like that.
I should point out that we are streaming this program now, so if you go to stateofthings.org, you can watch the program, and we have pictures of the birds and the bees. No bees. The birds and the bugs that we've been talking about at our website, stateofthings.org. Oh, so it's gotten a bad name, but it turns out they have parenting skills.
Yes. In general, bugs are actually a very good group in general of parents. They're lace bugs, but also many stink bugs. And in fact, a subfamily that has now been elevated to a family, the Acanthosomatidae, these are actually called parent bugs. That's their common name because they will guard the eggs. They will even guard the very young nymphs, which don't go out and feed until they're old enough to fend for themselves, basically.
Wow. Go ahead.
And actually, even a further strategy that's really amazing in insects is giant water bugs are very vicious, terrifying-looking insects. In fact, the largest hemipterans. These actually have parental care where the fathers actually take care of the eggs. The eggs are glued onto the back of the fathers, and they sit there and guard them. Basically, the mothers go off and do their thing, and father sits there with the eggs and waits for them to hatch, guards them from predators and
that's
such.
The way it was at our house. That's exactly how it happened at our house. That's so. And all of this stuff, I guess we get to the so what, and maybe we'll go around the table, but Dan, I'll start with you. I mean, we're making light of this, and obviously it's because of our sort of love-hate relationship with bugs. But the fact is, knowing about these insects, and of course our previous segment when we talked about birds and ecosystems, knowing about this is vital to us if we want to stay kind of healthy on this planet, isn't it?
Right, absolutely. Our work, you know, we talk about anesthesia or getting roaches to sleep, and I hear these guys talk about their projects and their research, and you know, it goes through my mind that wouldn't it be great to have a technique that you were sure you could get them to sleep, get them to be still, and then you could take your samples or you could, you know, put your devices or your tools or techniques to them and recover them safely. And so this is something that's really, you know, in invertebrates, it's kind of like the Wild West or the new frontiers. vet medicine, but it's really basic stuff otherwise and really important.
Well, let's stick with it for a minute. How basic is it? Because we know we have different respiratory systems and neurological systems. So how does what works for a hissing cockroach work for a mourning dove?
So that's a great question. On a cellular level, a lot of these things, in vet medicine, we work with a lot of different species with different, techniques and different mechanisms. But at a basic level, a lot of the cellular level operations are the same. From there, we have to sort of understand sort of the physiology and anatomy. And in this case, a lot of times we don't know if it'll work, but we know that this anesthetic gas or this medicine is something that's available and handy. We know all about it and a lot of other species. And if we can find tools like that that work, that we can apply across taxa and sort of expand into these new frontiers with invertebrates or with insects in this case, it really could improve our ability to work with these species, both as pets, that's the first answer a lot of people think of with a veterinarian, but also in wildlife species and agricultural species. This is Bugfest. We're talking about eating invertebrates, eating insects. At some point, if we need to maintain the health of colonies for our food, you also have to have this basic understanding of science and medicine.
We're getting a preview of Bugfest today on The State of Things. Dan Dabrowski is with us, chief veterinarian here at the Museum of Natural Sciences. Matt Bertone is also with us, an entomologist, and where Julie Urban is assistant director of genomics and the microlab. And, of course, there are practical applications when it comes to agriculture when we're looking at the digestive systems and all of the aspects of these insects that you're studying.
Yes, certainly. Plant hoppers, there are, a number of species, probably around 100, that are major world pests of major world commodities. But those are, even though there's not a high species number that are pests, they're really devastating. So, for example, there are a number of species that feed on rice. And when you get an outbreak of these plant hoppers in Asia, rice production will be reduced by 80%. So these are serious. And so by understanding the bacterial and fungal symbionts that these insects are relying upon, that provides another application for control, another way we can target controlling these
I have to ask you what's going to sound like a perverse question, because nobody wants to take rice out of anybody's mouth, and nobody wants to, and we're happy that we can secure our food supply. But we're talking about this ecology, this large kind of ecosystem. So when we intervene and we knock out what we consider a pest, and again, nobody wants to see the rice production go down to 20%, do we have to keep in mind that we've just made a nick in the entire ecosystem and be conscious of that?
Yes, certainly. Certainly. And because, everything, as we're seeing, everything is also nested even within the animal, because these insects actually will vector viruses or phytoplasmas. And so, you might be nicking and opening things up for another potential pathogen at that molecular level. Yes.
Well, the other interesting thing is the research, especially at this molecular level and at the DNA level, has also taught us that we don't now have to apply broadband pesticides. There are ways to interrupt the reproductive system that don't affect the entire environment. So even if you are going to take out a species, we don't have to take out every other species on either side of it.
Correct. And I think for me, the other application that's really exciting is more from the bioprospecting. As we're studying these bacteria in unexplored places, be they in a plant hopper, in your face mite, right? Then we're finding, and we're sequencing their genomes, we're finding that they can metabolize different compounds that we could potentially use. And so this is technology. We couldn't do this 10 years ago. So we're finding all sorts of new things by studying these bacteria that are previously unexplored.
Matt, wouldn't it be cool if these parenting bugs that you work with had the ability to anesthetize their young just for a night? Just for a night.
I'm not sure how bad the baby bugs are to their parents.
I mean, we just wake them up in the morning, but I need a good night's sleep. I want to thank you all for being on the program. And as I said, you can take a look at pictures of all this stuff at our website, stateofthings.org. So happy to be here at the Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. Dan Dabrowski is chief veterinarian here at the Museum of Natural Sciences. Julie Urban is assistant director of genomics in the microlab. And Matt Bertone is an entomologist with the North Carolina State University Plant Disease and Insect Clinic. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you very much.
Coming up next, we're going to take a hike along Ellerby Creek, a nature preserve in the middle of a city, and talk about why that's important. We'll do it on The State of Things. Please stay with us.